Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Royal here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are putting on a face mask and not breathing on anyone in association with allfootballshirts.com. Well, with the world going into shutdown with the coronavirus, it was very much a case of keep calm and carry on as far as the UK football authorities are concerned. But then Arsenal boss Mikel Arteta got struck down with the illness and now football has been put into lockdown. But what does this mean for the existing season? And how does it affect A, the Albion, and B, the other clubs up and down the country? I'll tell you what, Alan Wes, we need a boffin. And we've got one in the shape of Kieran Maguire of Price of Football fame and everywhere else,
and
pretty much.
Albion Royal fame.
Yeah,
I'm sure he made his media debut here, didn't he?
Something like that. Yeah.
We were just talking about that before we came on air, actually.
Sorry, for those of you not watching in radio, in super reverb vision, when you use the word boffin, Kieran's look was along the lines of, oh no, Palace have scored again. Hello, Kieran. How are you, mate?
I'm very good. I have actually been called a boffin in the national press. So,
yeah, to be fair, it was the Daily Star.
It was the Daily Star. Who also called me an egghead?
You've been called many things in all across the... we've had egghead. I think I went through them all the last time you were on, actually. Didn't I?
Charming.
That's right. And I'll keep this clean. One owner of an EFL club refers to me as Football Finance's effing Rain Man.
Oh dear.
Would this be a club in the East Midlands by any chance?
I can't possibly
comment now, but...
Well, Kieran, we're absolutely delighted to have you on, and obviously there is a global crisis going on at the moment, so who better to talk about that and how that's going to impact on football than you, because you are the expert. But we'll also hear from Paul Barber a little bit later on as well. So about how it's going to affect the Albion. But I mean, this is massive in terms of everything, really.
World history.
Yes. First of all, there are public health issues to deal with. Football isn't even secondary or third in the list. Football's an entertainment form at the end of the day. And I must say that some of the people in football have been absolutely superb. I don't know if people have listened to Jurgen Klopp's comments. He has got everything in proper perspective. The issues that affect football are not the football clubs themselves. In the Premier League, where we are at the Albion, it's further down the chain. My concerns are in respect of the stewards, the programme sellers, the suppliers of pies and so on, because it's their livelihoods and their cash flows which are most at stake.
Now, we're going to be talking to Paul Barber about that a little bit later on. But, I mean, the club have actually come out last night and said that they are going to continue to pay all the part-time staff up until whether the games take place or not this season. What that means...
That's quite something, isn't it? I mean, you know, that's a hit that the club is taking, and yet, you know, it's evidently done sort of, well, in good faith.
That's right. They didn't have to do it. They chose to do it because it's the right thing. You know, clearly, Tony and Paul have had a decision with the remaining members of the board, and I think it is a sign that for all the stick that Premier League clubs get, ultimately it comes down to the people involved. And I think we're very fortunate to have people that do have a social conscience and are aware of the broader issues that the benefits of the game that can bring.
Yeah, but in terms of the current league season, can you see it like carrying on?
Well, I think the 3-week suspension of activities is very, very optimistic. Clearly, what's going to happen during that period is the spread of the disease, you know, how quickly that's going to occur throughout the general population is going to be monitored by the health authorities. But what the Premier League and the EFL have done is to effectively give themselves some breathing space until we are closer to identifying just how quickly the disease is flowing through the population.
I mean, it's a hell of a way to stop Liverpool winning the league, isn't it?
Well, yeah, as somebody that works in Liverpool, I mean, to be fair, you know, all of my colleagues who are Reds, yeah, they can see the bigger picture too. Within all football clubs, fan bases, there are conspiracy theorists, you give those people a keyboard and they have a voice, sadly, but the vast majority of Liverpool fans are hoping that the season is going to be postponed rather than effectively cancelled.
Well, there is precedent for this, not in terms of a health. Well, I suppose you could argue in terms of a health thing. Now, for those who know this sort of thing, historically, the winter of 1962-63 was particularly horrific, and there were a lot of postponements to the point that, now I appreciate that football is different, sort of, you know, nearly 60 years later, but there were a lot of postponements to the point that, you know, the rest of the end of the season was concertina. They didn't really get back on track until mid March, but everything was concertina. And I think they pushed the cup final back and things like that. So there, even though we have, I mean, this is again purely speculatory, and this is the whole point about this, ironically enough, breathing space that the football must allow itself, and it must do it on a world basis. I mean, obviously, the FA has got to do this with all the various other foreign football associations. Is that there is precedent that the timetable can be allowed to slip? It can be allowed to be pushed back, and you know, UEFA's got to look at themselves and say, do we need the Euros, you know, in the sort of farcical form that we've got this summer? You know, is it absolutely imperative that happens? So we've been here before, although probably not on such a sort of a wide scale status, you know, in modern times.
But very much so. I think the quicker that UEFA cancel the Euro 2020 tournament, the better, because that will allow the domestic leagues throughout Europe a bit more flexibility. There will be complications, because if you, it doesn't affect the Albion to the same extent, if you take a look at clubs in the lower leagues, most contracts expire at the end of June. So if let's say that football doesn't resume until May, how are you going to fit in all of the remaining fixtures between May and the end of June? Because remember, there'll be playoffs as well potentially taking place. You could end up with a farcical situation that you go into your last fixture on the 30th of June, you play that, you get into the playoffs, and then you've got eight players from the squad because you're a League One or League Two team. Everybody there is on 1 and 2 year contracts. So you could lose your squad for the playoffs.
But I mean, presumably there would be a precedent then for particular clubs to, like, okay, look, we'll extend that contract until... they might be given new contracts anyway, but I mean, we'll extend the contract.
We're talking
for
about
a
those
month
whose
or whatever
contracts expire. Yeah, there just has to be flexibility. You don't have a choice here.
Well, but also we've got to consider that we are dealing with young men in their 20s and their careers and their futures. If they have an offer from another club which starts on the 1st of July for a 2 year contract, and you've been offered a pay as you play extension for the playoffs by your existing club, you've got to do what's best for your family. And I appreciate these are hypotheticals at present, but the legal ramifications, especially if the league is suspended, are going to be very complicated.
And let's not beat about the bush here. We're talking about League One and League Two players. We're not talking about the millionaires that you see at the top levels. These are players that aren't earning
the will be exactly the same problem. It's just it's more exacerbated when you've got when you're talking about relative wage terms. Messi, should he want to come and join Worthing, won't have a problem with his own sort of salary and lifestyle.
I'm sure Worthing would rather have Dean Hammond. Oh, they've got him.
In these various hypotheticals, and we can actually now sort of like work out what's going to happen, when it's going to restart and what have you. I can see the playoffs being done away with. It's something that, because of the extraordinary circumstances, it's not ideal for anyone, but there has to be so much flexibility from clubs, from just about everyone.
Yeah. I don't think we will necessarily see that flexibility, because there will be, whatever decision is made by the football authorities, there will be winners and losers. Yeah. So, for example, if they decide to effectively cancel this year's competitions and leave things as they are, you can expect a legal challenge from Leeds United and West Bromwich Albion, because they wouldn't get promoted. If they are going to say that that we are going to have promotion and relegation on the basis of the table as of today, then those clubs who are in the three bottom positions in the Premier League, they will take legal action against the Premier League, because they will say, well, hold on, if we won four matches out of our last nine, we would therefore have expected to avoid relegation.
I saw an argument today that for one season only, that the Premier League could be extended to 22 clubs for next season, but five teams get relegated the year after.
But there's any number of things that could happen. Do you think this is where also force majeure could come in?
Yes, I was reading an article yesterday by a guy called Nick DeMarco, Nick DiMarco works for Blackstone's Chambers. He is probably the leading sports lawyer in the country. He's represented Joey Barton, Tyson Fury. He was QPR's lawyer, and he's currently acting for Derby and Sheffield Wednesday. And he did bring up the issue of force majeure. It's not the strongest case reading his article, but... Yeah.
Just for people who don't know, can you just explain what force majeure actually is?
Well, force majeure is where there are unforeseen circumstances that could not have been predicted, which prevent people from filling contracts. So in respect of things such as should clubs give refunds, should the Premier League commit to allowing Leeds United and West Bromwich Albion to be promoted if the fixtures list is not fulfilled and things of this nature. The simple answer is there is no simple answer.
Well, but then there's the knock-on effect as well, because I mean you've got those two sides which are occupying first and second in the championship at the moment, but then you've got the sides underneath them who are in the playoffs who we're in this as well.
There is no one perfect solution.
We want a chance to get our 100 million whatever.
We've never been here. The point is we've never been here before, and so we've never had to deal with it. And you could actually therefore, I mean, if someone then says, you know, what are you going to deal with here? Plague of locusts, you know. A worldwide virus infection. You think, well, hang on, this is we're something out of Doctor Who here. This is something out of, you know, almost Ray Bradbury here. You know, but it's happening. And so, you know, this is a kind of a spooky sort of sci-fi now into sci-fact that we've gone to.
The thing is, no one really knows exactly what it is we're dealing with.
Well, that's another matter entirely.
I think what we have to do is perhaps just show a little bit of patience. And we are living in an instant society where we expect solutions immediately. It's going clearly from the latest medical discussions that it's going to take 12 to 18 months to develop a vaccine. So could it mean that football be suspended until mass gatherings can take place? Yeah. When people are deemed to be healthy enough.
Well, okay, well, let's just rewind a little bit then. So let's just rewind to Thursday night. So we're looking at the club had announced, the Premier League had announced, and the government had announced that the games this weekend were going to go ahead. We're all looking forward to the Arsenal game. There's lots of talk on social media, like, well, is it safe for us to go? Well, there was talk about are the over 70s they're going to be allowed in? And then all of a sudden, everything was going to be okay. Everything was going on, and then the news came out that Mikel Arteta had gone down with the illness as well. Now, I don't know where we got it, whether it was from the Olympiacos game or whatever. I mean, it was just a domino effect, wasn't it?
It's just one of those things. But the point is, it does have that effect. Arsenal then have to self-isolate, which is, you know, they cue a few running gags about how they normally do that anyway. But yeah, the logical thing is the game has to sort of not go ahead. Yeah. Arsenal won't be able to raise a team. There are health implications for just about everyone who comes into contact. And let's face it, this whole thing of the handshake before the game was slightly farcical, in as much as, you know, as soon as the players are on the pitch, they start snorkeling and gobbing at each other anyway.
We talked about this in the show last week. Are you talking about anyone in particular?
No, yes. But you... So you kind of got this. It is probably, given the medical information that's going out, and let's face it, none of us three as...
A child just walked past dressed as Darth Vader.
That actually feels appropriate, actually. That's the dark force measure. Stop it, you two. Right, live radio, professional. What was I saying? I've no idea. Carry on, AD. I cannot remember what I was saying.
And the thing was, take the coronavirus out of it. This was a game I was particularly looking forward to, because I thought this is where our first win of the season was going to, of 2020 was going to come in. I mean, if you watched the game against West Ham last week, if West Ham had goals rather than barn doors at the training ground, they would have won that handsomely. And Arsenal were definitely there for the taking at the moment. And the way that we've been playing, Graham Potter used a very strange analogy this week. He said about us not scoring goals. Yeah, he said it's trying to get sauce out of a bottle. And I'm hoping we're going to have a splurt on Saturday.
Charming.
It's very. I'm not. Poor old Graham Owen didn't quite know how to deal with that.
I don't think there's any way you could particularly react to that, is there? Yeah.
But I mean, obviously the game was cancelled, and that was when the domino effect started, and the Premier League.
Domino? I think they probably just got to realise that actually, if we're going to go down this route, then you know, for the sake of health, it is a you'd like to think it's a precautionary measure, but then. We're back to the whole notion of, as Kieran said, we're in the early stages of knowing what this is. You know, are we in this for a long haul? Is it something that's going to blow itself out? We don't know. And we just have to sort of like almost put society on hold for the time being and carry on as best we can. It sounds sort of like slightly apocalyptic, but it's not. I mean, we have it within us actually to sort of carry on quite comfortably. Yeah. And for all this thing about banning mass gatherings, that doesn't mean to say that you don't go to the pub with your mates.
Yeah. But I mean, Kieran, this has a massive knock-on effect. It's not just about the players, about the clubs. It's about the industry around the football, about the pubs, the restaurants, the suppliers to the ground. People like Piglet's Pantry, who how many clubs is it? They supply 20 clubs now.
It's quite a few.
So all of the stuff that they would have bought in. I mean, Kieran. What will happen?
Well, I think in respect of all small businesses, we need to see some leadership coming from central government. We've already seen this morning Morrison's, the supermarket, saying that it will pay all of its small suppliers immediately upon delivery. As from a financial perspective, the most important thing to deal with at this present moment in time is that of cash flow. It's no point saying, well, we're going to postpone games for 5 or 6 weeks. You've still got wages to pay, you've still got rent to pay, you've still got rates to pay, you've still got your VAT to pay during that period. We've not seen the government say to small companies, right, you don't have to go and pay your PAYE for 6 months. We don't have to pay your because the government itself is short of money. I think the initiative shown by the Albion is superb. I think the Premier League here could definitely show a lead because I looked at the balance sheets of each of the Premier League clubs in one of my legendary spreadsheets, and they've got over £1 billion between them as
cash in bank.
Now, let's take a look at the position of League One and League Two clubs. They have, on average, 6 home fixtures to fulfil. We've seen Southend United and Macclesfield Town both fail to pay wages in February. That means that they can't pay the wages in March, April and May because if they've not got fixtures to play. Why not get the Premier League clubs to say, or the Premier League as an institution, or to have a vote, an emergency meeting, to say, we are the football family. Let's not be naive. Harry Kane was on loan at Leyton Orient. It's good to have Leyton Orient in existence. Mm. Where did Jamie Vardy come from if you're a Leicester fan? He came from Fleetwood Town. It's therefore essential that we have Fleetwood Town in existence. What could happen is we say, well, what is the average amount of income that clubs are losing per home match? And I estimate it's around about £50,000 to £60,000 in League One and League Two. So you multiply that by 6. That's the amount of match day income that they can't afford to have. You multiply that by the 48 clubs. We're talking £18 million coming from the Premier League, which generates £3 to £4 billion a year. Coming from the as a stopgap. Now, they could say, we're going to give you an interest-free loan for 12 months. Once those fixtures have been fulfilled, assuming that they're postponed, you're then in a position to pay us back. Or we could simply say the Premier League, as a sign of its leadership within the football industry, is going to gift that money, is going to give £400,000 to each of the League One and League Two clubs. It's not going to solve everything, but it's going to give those clubs some breathing space. I think it will, certainly from a public relations perspective, show that the Premier League does have a social conscience. The Premier League was able to go and pay Richard Scudamore £5 million as a golden goodbye. Mm. Just trebling that amount for the clubs which are in need of cash, I think would be an excellent effort by them.
But I mean, and the government, what about the businesses? Like I said, we've used Piglets as a classic example. Like they supply pies up and down the country.
All the Harveys, you've got Heineken, you've got, you know, I know we've got the sort of the major multinationals, but you do also have a large local company, Harveys. You know, I wouldn't say they rely on it. They do have other places, but, you know, so we're using Piglets. Sorry, Joe, but, you know, her business model is based on mass gatherings.
Yeah.
there's a much broader issue here than football. The whole of the hospitality, the whole of the restaurant sector, the whole of the hotel sector is set to be struck by what's happening. I live in Manchester, or I have lived in Manchester most of my life. I was teaching at Salford early this week. I went for a walk through Chinatown in Manchester on Tuesday and Wednesday night. Mm. It was empty. And Chinatown in Manchester is big, it's thriving. Everybody is staying at home. The restaurants are empty, so they're having to lay off staff. We've got people who are, if you take the lower league football clubs, you've got the people who are supplying the catering, but you've got the people in the catering themselves on a match day. You've got the program sellers. You've got the stewards. These people rely on their four-hour shift, the 40 quid that they get from going to that match and being paid. They're using that to pay their gas bills, to pay their grocery bills. These people are being impacted just as much.
Which
as
is
the
why
football
it was so important that the Albion came out and actually said, you don't worry, you're going to get paid. So the rent, the mortgage and everything else gets paid.
Has there been a cultural backlash in Chinatown? By idiots?
There is evidence of one or two idiots in Manchester, as there are in all cities, who will take it against people. But that's because they are racists first and foremost, and the nature of being a racist is that you're always looking for an excuse to justify your bigoted views. Manchester historically is a very tolerant city, if you look at its history, and there has been a backlash against the idiots when that type of behaviour has taken place.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because where we broadcast from here, we're here in Brighton's open market. I'm just looking out the window here now.
You can't really tell us whether it's busy or empty.
I can because you've got your back to me. I've never seen it this busy for, well, I have, but not for
apart
a while.
From Christmas, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people milling around. It doesn't seem to be that much of an issue here at the moment. There's a few people sort of staying in, but
it's keep calm and shop locals. I saw a sign at the photo shop across the road.
It's kind of interesting you're saying about, because you know, the culture of when a game's on at the Amex is that the pubs, especially around the station, because there's an influx of people, first thing you do, you go to the Albert, you go to the Star, you go to the Grand Central, you go to the Caxton, wherever it is you might be. Or whatever. All those pubs within sort of, you know, 50, 100 yards of the station, they're the ones that are going to miss out on their 20 times a year hit. Now, that's one thing, but then you've also got the cultural knock-on of people just not going to go out to the pub anyway. So, but the big hit, I mean, the sort of the extra payday bonus that these people get, I suppose probably the Albert less so, but then they've got gigs on, which will probably be postponed.
Well, yeah, and because it's a gathering, and then you've got a knock-on effect of festival, things like the Great Escape, things like Glastonbury and all the other festivals that are going on where you have thousands of people converging on the same thing.
I work for an events company, and we're pushing everything back to the end of the year. And then taking a view from there, we were supposed to have a couple of events in June and July, but it's not so much as to whether the whole thing's going to blow over by then, but obviously we've got to market it as well. So
I think anything which involves discretionary spending, and that means eating out, drinking out, things of that nature, those industries are going to be the first ones which are going to be hit. I think you're absolutely right. Shop local, support your local businesses, also support your local people. If you've got a Facebook group for the locality, for the neighbourhood in which you live, go on it and say, if there's any old people who are scared of going out, I'll go and do your groceries for you. Just be a good citizen. This is an opportunity to prove that actually
society works.
That we are not as divided as we claim to.
Totally that. The street where I live in Worthing, it's we've got a street WhatsApp group, and there's a lot of elderly people in our little close there.
And I bet you send
and we put it
time.
Out there. Said, look, if anyone wants us to go out and do shopping for us, do it. And
That's fantastic.
It's great, and I'd encourage everyone to do that. But you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Aidy Packham. I'm here with Kieran Maguire and Alan Wares. Very shortly, we're going to be hearing from Albion CEO Paul Barber. But first, we have a shirt of the week as donated from our sponsor here at the Albion Roar, oldfootballshirts.com. I'm just going to pass this over to Kieran Maguire to describe this particular jersey for me. I quite like it, Kieran.
I'm colourblind, which could be a benefit.
So is Phil.
I think this is. this is either grey or green or
it's
black.
Green.
It's green.
It's grey okay. and black, actually. But
it's green, grey, and black triangles in random patterns on a shirt. It's got a big W on it, and I'm immediately thinking what that big W stands for. It's made by Kappa, and it's in the Hyundai A-League. Now, is that Australia?
That is Australia, yeah. I mean, it's. I actually really like this, actually. I mean, it's kind of... I mean, Kappa makes some really, really nice shirts, actually. I mean, historically and even now, it's something that we should... Maybe the Albion could look for.
And it also says inaugural season 2019-20, so it looks like... Is this the Oamaru Wanderers? Well, is it their first season in the A-League?
Well, there you go. Kieran, you spotted it. And this is what Phil Shelley from oldfootballshirts.com has to say about this particular shirt of the week. And he says, naturally, your shirt of the week this week is Antipodean. I picked this striking number up at SPT Football, which is a soccer store in the Blackburn suburb of Melbourne. This is the inaugural away shirt of Aussie A-League newcomers Western United. They're an expansion team. They were set up in 2019 to represent the west of Victoria State. They play the home games at the GMHBA Stadium in Geelong, and they have a capacity of 36,000. And also in the Mars Stadium in Ballarat, which has a capacity of 11,000. They're in the process of developing a 15,000 capacity soccer-specific stadium in Tarnite. The squad was assembled in late 2018, and so far so good. They sit third in the A-League at the time of writing, and the majority of the squad are locals, but there are a couple of links to the UK. Striker Bezar Besarina impressed the scouts at Burnley whilst playing for Albania, and he signed at Turf Moor in 2007. He did his cruciate ligament in a pre-season match, was out for the entire season, and never made the first team appearance for the Clarets. Midfielder Alessandro Diamanti he made 30 odd appearances for West Ham in 2009-2010 before his return to Italy and eventual move to the A-League. The only Brighton link he can find is that some Darth Seagulls fan sought out a Western United replica shirt on his holidays in February 2020. And Phil is now back in the UK.
Is he? I hope he hasn't brought death and disease with him.
Well, he hasn't been isolated just yet. Now, obviously, this is a time where everything's going on. It's a worrying time for everyone. But we're delighted to be joined by...
That's a good link. That's a lovely link.
By Albion Deputy Chairman, isn't it, Paul? Paul Barber. How are you, Paul? You're okay?
Yes, I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm good. Now, Paul, we'll start with the amazing gesture that the club made yesterday in announcing that they're going to be paying all the part-time staff at the Amex until the end of the season. That's an amazing gesture.
Well, I think it's very easy to forget that sometimes the lower-paid people in our operation are the most important. And, you know, without our matchday staff, we wouldn't be able to put games on. And they're people that very often... either have work with us as an extra job or a top-up to pension, or they're a student, and that's very important to them, the income that they receive from us. So to cancel today's game at such short notice was obviously going to be impacting them quite badly, and we just felt that it was the right thing to do given the uncertainty over our remaining home games. We need them. If we play the games, even if we play the games behind closed doors, we're going to need some of them for support on the day. And we felt it was the right thing to do for the local economy as well. You know, all of our match day staff, by and large, live in and around the city or the surrounding areas. And it felt like the absolute right thing to do. So I'm glad it's been well received, but it was the right thing.
Yeah, Paul. Also, the food that was meant to be going into the hospitality lounges was also donated to various homeless centres around the city last night.
Yes, again, it would have been an incredible waste to see all the food that we'd ordered for today's game and couldn't cancel for today's game, literally going into an incinerator. So we worked with Sodexo, our partners, to make sure that as much of the food that was reusable, not like just last night, but also over this weekend, got its way to the homeless shelters in the city. And that included fresh fruit and vegetables, as well as sandwiches and a whole range of fantastic meat and various other things that we'd lined up for today, not just in the hospitality lounges, but also in the concourses as well. So again, it's the right thing to do. We don't need to to receive any praise for doing it, because I think it's absolutely, in these times, a sensible thing to do as well.
Well, it's something that I mean, hopefully it will have seen the other clubs up and down the country do exactly the same. I know Aston Villa have done that in Birmingham, so that's great. But I mean, Paul, this is worrying times. No one's really quite sure what's happened. How are the Albion going to cope with all of this?
Well, I think like everyone else, we're trying to work through so many different issues. I was just saying on the BBC's Football Focus just now that we've probably got around 200 or 300 things on a list now of issues that we need to work through if the season is going to be stopping here, which is a possibility. If we're going to be playing games behind closed doors, which is another possibility, or if at some stage in the future we're going to be able to get the season back on track with fans in the stadium. All of those things at the moment seem like a long way away. We're not close to making a decision on the season, and we're certainly not close to getting back to playing. And in the meantime, we've got a very large business that employs a large number of people to consider. And it's not easy because we haven't got now the income coming in on match day, which, despite people's assertions that it isn't important income, it's and we haven't now got that. And likewise, through the pyramid of the football system in this country, some of the smaller clubs are going to find that even harder, because whilst we've got the relative security of the TV income, those clubs haven't. Of course, we've then got the situation where, if we're together, what do we do with that TV income? Are we due to pay it back? Will Sky allow us to continue over a period of time with their contract? We just don't know. There are so many unanswered questions. But in the meantime, we've still got to pay our staff's wages. We've still got to maintain a professional approach, because we need to be ready to play. And it's a very, very uncertain and very difficult time for everybody.
Paul, tell us about the... it's Alan here. Tell us about the conversations that you're having with, one assumes, the Premier League and the Football Association, and I assume the Football League as well. And one would assume that even though it's not directly linked, I guess UEFA as well. Is it a constant dialogue, or is it are you meeting up now and again? I mean, because obviously, In this country, you've got 20 clubs with their considerations, then you've got other clubs across the continent, especially Italy. I mean, that's gone completely potty. So tell us about how the conversations, how they rise, and how the dialogue is continuing.
Well, first of all, over the last few days, Al, the dialogue has been hourly. It hasn't just been daily, it's been hourly. Things have been changing constantly, as they are generally across the whole country. And, you know, I would say that we're not the only business affected here. You know, football's just one industry. I think just about every industry that I can think of is going through similar challenges and worries to our own. But we've had constant dialogue with the Premier League. We've tried to make sure that wherever there's been an opportunity to put our views forward, then the club has a point of view, and we make sure that it's heard. You know, our view was that suspending games was absolutely the right thing to do. We've got to put people's health first. That has to be the priority. And again, it's easy to think that being in an outdoor space is according to the government, the right thing and an okay thing. But we've also got the concerns of our staff, who have got to stand in their various positions, unable to comply with government health guidelines of being a metre apart from everyone, unable not to have contact with hundreds, if not thousands, of people in a very short space of time. So it's not just about what we can do on the field, but how we manage things off the field. And on top of that, you've got all of the considerations of when players get sick or staff around them get sick, that you've then got to self-isolate. Self-isolate doesn't just mean for the 14 days. If you're a professional athlete, you've then got to prepare for the game. And probably for each day of self-isolation, you've got to have at least half a day to a day of training to get back to a relative degree of match fitness. You know, professional elite athletes lose their fitness levels very, very rapidly, and 14 days of self-isolation would massively contribute to that. Mm. So, you know, there's so many considerations here that are not as simple as just simply playing a game behind closed doors, or, you know, getting the game back on in 5 or 6 weeks' time. It's not quite as simple as that, unfortunately.
Now, Paul, obviously the league's now out until the 3rd of April.
That's pretty optimistic, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll speak to you. You think that's optimistic, don't you?
I think it is. I think if you think about it logically, we've got four or five teams now that have self-isolated their entire first team squads. Well, that's 2 weeks from now that they, in theory, come out of self-isolation. And as I've just said, they've then got a period of at least 7 days before they are going to be ready to be anywhere near match fit. And if we get into a situation where some teams are going into games not match fit, then the integrity of the competition starts to become an issue. Because depending on who those teams are and who they are playing, that could have a material impact on certainly the bottom six places in the Premier League, which in turn has a massive financial consequence if there was to be any issue over weakened teams or unfit players playing in those sort of games.
So this is hugely complex. Go on.
No, this is, I'm just saying this is hugely complex and not quite as simple as some of the media portraying in terms of self-isolation and delays to the Premier League restarting on the 3rd of April. It's not quite as simple as that.
So, I mean, as it stands at the moment then, so what are the players actually doing? Are they in training still or are they isolating?
No, absolutely. We're fortunate. We haven't got any members of our first team squad or staff that are connected in any way, directly or indirectly, to the virus. So we've got no one in self-isolation in that group. We have got five staff members who have self-isolated as a precaution because they've either come into contact with people that may have had contact with people with the virus or have travelled to areas where the virus is prevalent. So again, we've taken every precaution with those people. But at the moment, the players are training, they're prepared to play, they're ready to play, and we have to try and maintain that level of fitness and match readiness as long as we can through this period, because we do have to be ready to play on the 3rd of April. That's what the Premier League have asked us to do. As unlikely as that may seem at the moment, and I do think it's unlikely, we've still got to be ready.
I mean, I read some reports earlier this week of a couple of clubs that they're trying to keep the players a metre apart in training. and it just doesn't seem to be quite right. I mean, it's a contact sport. You're going to come into contact with people. So, I mean, it is worrying at the moment about what exactly is going to happen. And obviously, we've got huge knock-on effects here. We're in a championship summer. We've got the Amex being involved in the Euro and the Women's Euros next season as well, which looks like that could get moved back a year. I mean, it's not just the here and now. It's the future events as well, isn't it, Paul?
It is. And of course, you know, the impact of delaying the season would be significant, not just because of the summer tournaments, but also into next season. And if you impact next season, then you're going to impact next summer as well. And it's then very hard to get to a point where you can get back to normal, whatever normal is going to be in the future, very easily. So that's why I think you're seeing stories today of, you know, the league perhaps being suspended at this moment. You know, permanently, positions frozen, you know, records expunged. You know, there's a whole bunch of different scenarios out there, but there will come a point when we're going to have to seriously consider some of those.
Yeah, so, I mean, Paul, so in terms of that then, I mean, obviously Liverpool currently 24-25 points clear at the top of the league. You've got the bottom three. I mean, I've seen talk that they may even go to 22 teams next season. But, I mean, there's so many...
Nothing's been decided, though. I mean, that's the point.
Crazy.
We're at such an early stage here that, you know, the speculation... I'm assuming that this is the case, Paul, that speculation really is speculation. You guys actually haven't sat down to work out what's going to happen. I assume that's sort of like item 600 on the agenda at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we've got to, first of all, deal with the immediate issue that we're facing, which is, you know, how can we play our part, however small, in helping to prevent this virus spreading even further, even faster? And then once we've done that, is there any prospect of playing games on the 3rd of April? And if there is, how are we going to do that? Is that behind closed doors? And if we can't do that, then we've then got to start looking at what potentially could happen beyond that in terms of the season and whether we can even delay even further. But if you think about it, if you're delaying to the 3rd of April already and then you end up delaying, let's say, another 2 weeks after that, you're then into the middle of April. You could by then have other teams, other clubs in self-isolation. That would create a further delay. And before you know it, you're in the middle of May and the summer break that all of the players look forward to, everyone in football, frankly, looks forward to, is suddenly upon us. If you play through that, then suddenly you're impacting in the following season. So, you know, it goes all the way back then into a circular argument of what point you draw a line under where we are. Mm. And as much as our intention is to complete the season, that's what everyone wants, not just clubs and players, but fans as well, just because everyone wants the integrity of the competition to be absolutely maintained, then we have to sort of start thinking seriously of the alternatives if that can't happen.
But Paul, we've got a football finance expert in the studio with us in the shape of Kieran McGuire.
Sorry, he's a boffin, remember?
He's a boffin, yeah. This is true. And we've been talking on the show about the knock-on effect in terms of the lower league clubs. I mean, we were talking earlier about what would happen if we were still in League One or League Two, playing with Dean and not having the footfall or the income of having like fans coming through the gate. And we're talking about the possibility is of maybe solidarity payments to the lower leagues from the Premier League to help those clubs in the short term. Is that something that could actually happen?
Sorry, you broke up then. I didn't quite hear the question.
Basically, I think what AD was saying was that there's a fair amount of with the money that's generated in the Premier League versus what's generated in League One and League Two, and the extent to which footfall is so much more important in League One and League Two compared to the Premier League. Is there have the Premier League sort of started looking at a wider picture just yet to say, could we actually sort of like, you know, as we were saying, Glenn Murray started at Carlisle United. You look at other players who started at low. Without those smaller clubs, there would be no bigger clubs. There would be no a lot of these great players wouldn't have happened. Is there something that the Premier League can look at further down the line to say we can help you, because, like I say, the footfall has now gone, and the footfall is actually a major part of their income.
Well, the football pyramid is the most precious thing that we've got. You know, when I've worked overseas, whether it's been living overseas or working with the FA overseas, you know, everyone wants to talk about the pyramid and how we manage to sustain 92 professional clubs. So for me, preserving it is absolutely vital. How we do that, I think, is a much more complex question. And again, a lot of people don't appreciate quite how much money already flows from the Premier League and the FA down to the lower levels. Parachute payments is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to money filtering down from the Premier League to the next level of football. 50% of the FA's income, most of which is generated by elite players, whether it's playing for England or playing in the cup competitions, ends up in the lower levels of the English football pyramid. So the Premier League already plays a massive part in generating income for the lower levels of the game. Where you have to be really careful in, you know, I've seen some of the suggestions in newspapers of donating money to clubs or adopting local clubs, is that, again, you're in danger of damaging the integrity of the competition if one club, for example, gets adopted by a richer cousin than another. You have to be really careful that you get those sort of things right. So they're going to take a lot of thinking through. It could well be that there's some extra help from somewhere, somehow. And it would, in my opinion, be absolutely right, because we need to preserve the pyramid and also not forget just how important local football clubs are to their immediate communities, not just in terms of jobs, but also in terms of the spirit of that community and what people look forward to at the end of a working week.
And the local economy as well. I mean, we're not just talking about the football clubs, we're talking about the bars, the pubs, the restaurants, everything.
Absolutely critical. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why we wanted to carry on helping our own match day staff, because by and large, they're local people who will be spending that money in the local economy, which in turn is helping to preserve and hopefully foster those other jobs in that community. So, you know, this is a really complex situation. And the one thing I would say about the FA and the Premier League is at the moment they're dealing with a huge issue. And one of the reasons I think that the government were delaying playing matches behind closed doors for as long as they could is that they know how important matches are to local football clubs going ahead, and local economies and local communities. So in fairness, you know, if the medical experts and the scientists are saying it's safe to go to football, you can understand why the government were trying their best to keep those matches going on for as long as they did. Unfortunately, I think events overtook us. And when you start getting a situation where the clubs themselves and their staff and their players and their coaches are becoming infected, and the risk then to those communities or the fans supporting those clubs becomes even greater, then you've got to do what we did and take the right course of action, which is to suspend the games.
But football without fans is nothing, Paul. And, like, you know, having a rocking Amex behind a team, like against Arsenal, against Man United, against Liverpool, in games that are crucial for us in terms of getting points on the board and trying to keep up. I mean, it's having losing that 12th man, as it were, playing behind closed doors would have a massive impact.
It's going to be the same for every club, though, isn't it? I mean, you know, when you go to Old Trafford, though, AD, you got, you know, they're going to want their 70,000, well, sorry, their 30,000 regular fans. when you go to...
Yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, you know, professional football is designed to be played in front of a live audience as well as a television audience. And, you know, we would certainly, I think, you know, not enjoy playing at the Amex against, you know, Manchester United, Manchester City, Liverpool, Arsenal, without anyone in the stands. You know, we could argue that going to Norwich City, to not having their fans there would perhaps give us a marginal advantage against what we would have had if the stadium had been full. But I just don't think we need to think like that. I think, you know, we're in the entertainment business. We want fans in the stadium. We want people to enjoy their day out of football. We all love it. We all want to be there and not to be there and to watch it on TV in a very sterile atmosphere, to me, would be very strange, and, you know, something that I really would not like and not really want. I would rather we looked at other alternatives. I accept that if that's the best thing for the integrity of our competition, to preserve people's jobs, to preserve people's lives, which is by far the most important thing, then of course we'd have to accept that. Yeah. But if there was a better alternative, I would rather wait for it.
In the great scheme of things, Paul, and I appreciate it's going to be difficult, and I'm trying not to get too much in terms of confidential information out of you here. Well, I'd like to, but you know, how long do you think that certainly the Albion and or the Premier League could sustain this suspension?
I honestly don't know the answer to that, because each club will be different. Each club will have different income streams. But again, we've got to remember that it's not just our football income that's being affected here. You know, virtually all of our non-match day events have been or are likely to be cancelled over the next few weeks and possibly months as well. So it's really hard to see through this at the moment, because we've never ever been in this situation. I was thinking about it driving into the office today, that we've never faced, I can never remember in my time being involved in a business that is facing this kind of lockdown of all its operations, and our ability to generate income has virtually disappeared overnight. I can't think of a single situation. Perhaps 9/11 for the airline industry was the closest. But you know, this is far, far, far more widespread across each country, across each part of the world, than even 9/11. And that was catastrophic, not least for the people that lost their lives, but the business implications of that as well were huge. This is even bigger and even more concerning, because there's no immediate end to this. There's no immediate pathway through the difficulties that different businesses are going to have. And as I said earlier, the football industry is just one. You know, I've got real concerns for businesses right the way across our community, right the way across our country, and what effect that's going to have for a long time to come. So, you know, it's easy to sometimes become quite parochial and worry about a Premier League football match going ahead or not. But I think we've got to worry about far bigger things than just one Premier League match at the moment.
I think this actually then recreates the point that Kieran made earlier, is actually about supporting your local shop, about supporting your local community. I think that, you know, this, like I say, the likes of the Albion, a major employer in the city, absolutely, you know, it's something that's going to be vital for the area. American Express, another huge employer in the city, but there's also the nature of this city is, you know, it's a city of entrepreneurs. It's, you know, you go to North Lane, you've got every single quirky shop. I think it's all the more vital now, where national chains can probably be sort of soak some of this up, except for, you know, when it comes to loo roll. But the local shops, if you ask, I mean, life still does go on. We're still going to carry on here. But, you know, where you are going to buy stuff, then consider shopping locally and keep the economy going.
Totally agree. And, you know, I think we should all do that as much as we can, particularly over the next weeks, where, you know, people are going to be depending on each of us to support each other. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a very, very difficult time. There's no doubt about that.
Okay. Okay, we'll leave it there, Paul. Thanks very much for your time and joining us. Keep us posted about what's going on. And hopefully we won't have to speak to you again too soon. But
that's not very nice,
well,
is it?
I mean it in the best possible way, because hopefully we
taken
can get
in the best possible way.
We all want to get back on track, and we all want to get back out on the pitch and actually hopefully.
And you just want to drink beer, don't you, AD?
Well, then something's never changed.
Absolutely. But, thanks, Paul.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Albion Deputy Chairman Paul Barber joining us there and taking time out of his. He's very, very busy at the moment.
Well, so especially being on BBC, you know, and then coming, you know, sort of coming to us, you know. Kieran, what did you make of what was said there?
Well, as always, I think Paul speaks a huge amount of sense. He's able to see the bigger picture, and I think what he said should really be followed. There are effectively three alternatives that are available to the Premier League. Those decisions shouldn't be rushed. Should it be suspended? Should it be postponed? Should it take place behind closed doors? And that the benefits of each of those decisions will be constantly evolving as we get further and further information in terms of the spread of the disease.
Okay. Well, there's not much we can really add to it, to be honest.
Notice board's a bit pointless this week, isn't it?
Yeah. Well,
we did do something last night.
We did have the Rev quiz last night, and you're apparently going to give us some questions.
Can I just say, first and foremost, thank you to everyone who came along. There were a few people who came along. We got 80 people came along last night. It's not quite the record 150, 160, but it was a nice half-full Heineken lounge. We managed to raise £400, which was great. We've finished up on that, so thank you to everyone who came along. We have new winners. Our good friend Steve Gase, who was on a few weeks ago,
a good week for him, isn't it? Countdown earlier in the week, and now this.
I know. I mean, what's going on?
And what's better, a countdown teapot or the Renf trophy? That is,
there is no comparison. No, and I would not be. Who presents Countdown these days?
Nick Cure.
Oh, okay, right. So I was about to say.
And Rachel Riley was still there.
Oh, right, okay, fair enough. Congratulations, Steve. His team, Queen's Park Strangers, absolutely destroyed everyone. And they are the new green slime. So well done, them. Yes, did some various rounds. And probably this is where we have a bit of dead air. And I ask from memory some Albion related questions. As anyone who's been to the Renf Chris knows, I always do an Albion related round. And it's always the worst scoring round because I don't think I ask particularly hard questions. It's just one of those where you think I've got one of 11 to pick from,
one. It's usually the round where you get called the worst names.
I did manage to survive it. I did actually one question I did get booed. It was right, but I got booed for it. So
go on then.
Okay. First and foremost, I'm going to do this from memory now. Who was the last Albion player to score a goal in League One?
In the League One, that was
Elliot Bennett.
No.
It was the game against Huddersfield.
Nope.
That was the last game. Well, that was the last game at Withdean, wasn't it? So, did we have an away game after that? I'm sure that Huddersfield
the
game.
The answer is Ashley Barnes at Notts County.
Oh, of course, yes.
That was our last away game.
Yeah.
No, you're right about sort of before we hit the beach.
Yeah.
Right. What is the higher number? Actually, I think this was from another round. What is the higher number? The number of goals Glenn Murray has scored for Brighton or the number of test runs that Jofra Archer has scored for England?
So the number of goals that Glenn Murray scored for the Albion or test runs by Joff?
Yes.
I'm going to say goals by Glenn.
And you're going to say?
I'm going Glenn.
It is Glenn. 111 to 97.
Although Joff should probably score more runs for England because he is a very good batsman.
He is, yeah. When he remembers to sort of not necessarily swing quite so wildly. Which Albion player who has played for the Albion this season was born nearest the equator? And I actually ran this question last year
you
as well.
Did, and it's a different answer.
You do not question the question master. The question master is always right, and if in disputes, see above.
Nearest the equator, I'd argue it would be Heath Basuma, but
Kieran, any ideas?
I'm going Matt Ryan.
No, it's actually Gaetan Bong.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Basuma is very close.
But he's not a current Albion player.
I didn't say that. I said who's played for us this season.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay.
Oh, someone challenged me on that as well. I thought it was going to be a glove.
Everyone's always challenged.
Absolutely. Now you've got to listen to the question. Which Albion player from this, or current Albion player, was born? I think you know the answer, Eddie. So, Kieran, which Albion player was born in Plumpton? You know this one, don't you?
Plumpton.
Yeah. I can. This is the first time.
Pick me.
I'll go Solly March.
A lot of people said that. Go on, AD.
Matt Ryan.
It is Plumpton, being a suburb of Sydney.
Oh, very good. Hoody hoody ho.
Hoody hoody ho.
Heedy heedy he.
Okay, who is the Albion's all-time leading League Cup scorer, or League Cup in its various sponsorship?
Glenn.
Michael Robinson.
Peter Ward.
There you go.
Peter Ward. I've got to try and do the rest from memory. I can't.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll save those
absolutely,
for next week.
Because
we're probably going to be touching on this with no real football to talk about.
We're going to go back to rock and goal soon.
Yeah, probably will have to, yeah. With no real football to talk about at the moment, we've been putting out on our social media channels just to. What is your favourite Albion game of all time? It doesn't have to be the best, doesn't have to be the worst. It could be your first, your last. Just the one that really stands out for you as your favourite Albion game.
You go first, Kieran.
For me, FA Cup 1983, fifth round at Anfield. I was at Manchester University at the time, got on the train, which was delayed from Oxford Road in Manchester. We arrived sort of just before the kickoff. And as we were walking up towards the gates, all we could hear with me and my mates were Albion, Albion, Albion. We weren't expecting a big turnout. And we got there. And in terms of one of the greatest vocal performances from the Albion, I think that lives long in the memory. And clearly the match itself, Jimmy Case scoring the winning goal, Phil Neal missing a penalty.
I think
in front
he had the post, didn't it? Yeah.
And then Jimmy Melia's dance. At the end of the match, and you've got to give the Liverpool fans a huge amount of credit. They were absolutely superb to us.
Well, magnanimous.
They were both before and after the match, but also in the way that because one of their own was managing the club and one of their own had scored the winning goal,
sure.
They were very accepting of the result.
I mean, we're going to go through these another, probably next week now, but we've had some, we're keeping coming, we've had some brilliant answers. Quite a lot of you have gone with the 83 semi-final at Highbury.
Jimmy Case obviously. Again. Jimmy Case got us to the cup final, frankly, didn't he?
Yeah.
And that was a poignant one as well. I mean, obviously,
what about you, Adie? What's your answer?
Well, it changes weekly, but I mean, being me, of course, it's going to be something completely obscure. But I was thinking about this before I asked the question yesterday.
Go on.
I'm actually there's one that really stands out for me for no other reason that it just basically cemented my love of the Albion.
Go on.
It was a completely bonkers game. I can tell you the date. It was November the 16th, 1985.
Mm-hmm.
It was a home game against Huddersfield Town. And Brighton won 4-3. Two players got sent off. It was a game that had absolutely everything. It was mental, and even Mick Ferguson scored. It was
wow.
It was great. Alan Biley scored as well. Eric
Young. Was it a nighttime game?
No, it wasn't.
Okay,
but it was just an absolute. And it was just one of those games. It was a nightmare to get to. I can't remember however old I was at the time, 12 or something, and it's like I just wanted to get there.
Still 12,
and I got there by hook or by crook, and it was just something that
it was worth it. It made it all worth it.
You know, you just come out of it, you go, yeah, this is me, this is where I'm at, and it's just something I absolutely remembered it for ever since. Really,
I've got to be honest, it's two favourite games or two of the best games that I wasn't there at, and I actually. Was made a point, not made a point of missing, but really regretted missing. That people come back to me and say, and they're kind of puffing on cigar cut type game.
One this was, is the Reading game, isn't it?
One was the Reading game at home where we won 3-1 with the exploding net, and the other one was the 3-0 at Peterborough, which I dipped out on.
Both good answers.
Those ones I missed out on. But next week, when we go through this, I'll go through my game that was my favourite.
And we'll have lots of your memory games as
absolutely.
Well. But that's all we've got time for this week. Thank you, everyone, so much for listening. Thank you to Kieran Maguire for joining us. Thank you to Alan Wares. Thank you to Paul Barber. I've been Ailey Packham. We'll be back next week with some sort of show.
And this one is.
Not quite sure what kind of a show.
We've never had Peter Canning on the show, but Pete, this is for you.